I'm Jennifer Grumhouse. I'm the Executive Director of North Chicago Community Partners. Everyone around knows this is NCCP. We're here today at the high school, not our regular place of business and place to do work. Because schools are closed, we've reinvented North Chicago Community Partners to continue to serve our students and families. Instead of tutoring, instead of mentoring, instead of after-school programs, we're actually distributing food. We're distributing learning kits, which is some of what you see on the table. We're distributing hygiene kits, household kits, pet food, anything families need to stay safe, to stay engaged, to stay fed, to stay nourished, to stay connected during this pretty difficult time. We're excited to launch our new Work From Home volunteer program. We're excited to keep you connected, and we need your help. There's 15 of us working every day in two different locations and multiple shifts, trying to work from home, but we can't do all that needs to be done. We're giving food bags out to 300 people a week. Someone needs to assemble those bags. We have learning kits, 1,500 components a week that have to be created and put together. We need help. So we're thrilled that the church is understanding the needs of the community, is continuing to support them. It's been shocking, actually, to talk to our families at food distributions. The distance is hard. The keeping kids busy is hard. But all of it is much more difficult if you're living in an under-resourced community where food is scarce and jobs are leaving and families are struggling just to stay whole. So we're really hoping the work that we're doing now through the community school model unites people, meets their basic needs, keeps children engaged, keeps them excited to learn, but also keeps you all, keeps the churches and the volunteers engaged.
Well, I want to start by thanking North Chicago Community Partners for their ongoing work in North Chicago and for opportunities for us to be involved in that. Appreciate Jennifer Grumhouse and her leadership there. Appreciate all of you that have signed up through NCCP or through other opportunities. I want to acknowledge that we have more people who have signed up to help than we have been able to generate places for you to serve. And on the one hand, I'm sad about that because I think serving is one of the ways we find some redemption and validation and meaning in this time of sheltering at home. But at the same time, I'm glad. I sort of hope and pray that we come through this whole COVID crisis with more people sitting on the bench saying, "Put me in the game. Put me in the game. I want to serve." And of course, you have lots of opportunities to serve in your neighborhood, in your home, serving each other. So, thanks to NCCP. So, the words, my God, why have you forsaken me?" are very famous words. They are the first words in Psalm 22. They are among the very last words that Jesus speaks when he's on the cross before he dies. And they're perfect words for us as we sort of segue into today's topic. So there's lots of reasons somebody would cry out at God. Like, "God, where are you? Why are you not helping me? Why are you letting me go through this?" Could be cancer. Could be the death of a loved one. It could be chronic unemployment. It could be sort of ongoing loneliness. It could be all kinds of things could lead people to say, "God, what's going on? Why aren't you answering my prayer? Why aren't you helping me?" Today, I want to ask that question against the context of COVID-19. Now, I realize that some of you were hoping for a COVID-19 free hour. And so I want to assure you, I'm not talking about the virus. I'm not qualified to talk about the virus. And I have no interest in talking about the virus. But I do want to think about it because there is a global pandemic going on. And I want to frame my comments to some things that I think might be going on in your own heart and mind as this thing rolls forward. Now, this is a bit of a challenge because we're coming at this from such different vantage points. It became obvious to me late this week that although it sort of looks like everyone is going through the same thing together, we're sheltering in place and everyone's behind closed doors for the most part. Some of you are out working in the medical field and other things. There's lots of or jobs that have been deemed essential, but most of us are at home. And so it looks like people are doing the same kinds of things. And yet it became obvious to me through some conversations and just some reflection that people come at this from very different vantage points. So some of you are saying, you know, this is not bad. This is sort of quiet and reflective, and I appreciate this forced recess. And others are saying, quiet, reflective, forced recess. Oh my goodness, there are six of us in my home, and three of them are under the age of five, and it's chaos all the time, and I have never been busier. We're completely redoing everything at work, and so I'm taking Zoom calls morning, noon, and night, and it's crazy. Some of you are going through this from a position of financial stability, and others are saying, look, I got let go, or if I don't get a paycheck quickly, I'm not going to be able to continue to buy groceries or to make the rent payment or the mortgage payment. And some of you are in a position where you're enjoying a lot of peace in the midst of this, and some of you are very anxious in the midst of this for any one of a whole bunch of different reasons. And so things are different, and for that matter, we come at this very differently. Some of you have gone through what Alec Hill, a couple months ago, the two-time cancer survivor, described as the existential slap that he had. You have been thrown to the mat by life and circumstances, and you've already wrestled in a time of confusion and wonder, like, where is God? And is God who I think he is? And is God really for me? And is he loving? And what's the path forward? And you sort of went through that and came out in a very different place, in a stronger place. And so this challenge doesn't unsettle you like it might for others who have not been through those kind of challenges in the past. So I just want to recognize that we're going through this from different vantage points, and this pandemic is raising different issues for different people at different times. So, by the way, Alec Hill, wrote this book, Alec Hill recently had an article that came out because he was in isolation for a year. And so he reflected on his time of social isolation and what he did and how he grew through that. And so I'm going to post that article on my Friday update for those of you who are interested. My point is that we're coming at this issue from different vantage points. And some of you have been through some things like this, and some of you have not. That makes crafting a sermon a challenge at this moment. But I want to talk about suffering because some of you are not very good at it. Most of us are not very good at it. We've lived in an advanced society, medically, technologically. We haven't had to suffer very much. In Macbeth, Shakespeare has this line, "Each new morning, new widows howl, new orphans cry, new sorrows strike heaven upon the face." And I think when I read that, yes, that's true for today. There are widows howling. There are orphans crying. There are injustices that cause people to wonder about God. But that seems like a lot more of what used to happen than what happens today. So I want to talk about suffering because we're not very practiced with it. I want to talk about suffering because it's a possible greenhouse for spiritual growth. And I want to talk about suffering because I want to help you process it. Suffering can be a situation in which your life and faith become shipwrecked. And I want to allow you to use Scripture to be a light unto your feet, a lamp unto your path, and to guide you as you think well about this. So to be honest, it doesn't actually feel to me like what I want to share is a sermon. I thought about actually not having this recorded at the church. I thought about having it recorded at our kitchen table. And I was going to be sitting down because it seems more like an extended conversation over a meal. I have these conversations about suffering quite a bit. That's one of the conversations as a pastor you have. And I'm used to it in the one hand, but they're always, these conversations are always very contextualized. I mean, it's a very different conversation to talk about the problem of pain, the problem of evil, you know, what, where is God when I'm hurting and suffering? Very different to have that conversation in an intellectual environment, like sitting in a Starbucks with a college student home from spring break who's just had a philosophy class and has now got new questions, or had a World Civ class and has heard about some of the things that happened in the past and is now trying to rethink things and make some sense of things. That's a very different conversation than having a discussion about suffering and the question of where is God in a hospital room when someone has just gotten a bad diagnosis, or when someone they love has just passed away. Or it's very different than having a conversation with somebody on a Sunday morning who is at church and is struggling and saying, how long should I expect to be trapped in this life that is not working, or in this cycle of addiction, or whatever it is? So I want to acknowledge that this sermon is hard to preach, and it's harder to preach, of course, because I have no feedback. I can't tell who's yawning and who's crying and whose eyes are glazed over and whether or not I should keep going or pivot. So I could complain about this sermon, but I think it's very important, and I want to talk about suffering because it's possible that some of you are, well, I know some of you are suffering now, and it's possible some of you who are not suffering now are going to be suffering, and I want to help frame it. And so I come at this with an understanding that there's at least two different questions out there. Some of you are looking for answers to the question of suffering, the problem of pain, however you want to frame this. Some of you are looking for answers that satisfy your head. You're trying to think this through, and it is unsettling your understanding of God and faith and how this worked out and who God is and all of that. And some of you are looking for answers that satisfy your heart. So what I want to do is I want to share enough to sort of let those of you who are looking for answers that satisfy your head be persuaded that those answers are out there. The Christian faith has got rich resources for people to think well about some of the big questions that are out there. And so I want to be sure that you know that and that you know where you can go. And then I want to circle around and we're going to come to the answer, I think the most profound answer that does speak to our heart, and we're going to come to this communion table at the end. So let me start by saying those of you who are looking at answers that are intellectually rigorous, let me say, first of all, this question, the problem of pain, the questions raised by suffering, the problem of evil, it is a big question. It's actually one of the big sub-questions under what we call the problem of evil. Now, the Bible doesn't call it the problem of evil, but philosophers do, and for more than 2,000 years, there has been this quote-unquote problem, and people have said, look, if God is all-knowing, and God is all-loving, and God is all-powerful, then evil shouldn't exist, but evil exists. Therefore, God is either not aware of it, or he's not able to do anything about it, or he doesn't care to do anything about it because he's not good. So this is a problem that was first framed by Epicurus about 300 BC. He was a Greek philosopher, but it's been restated, and it's rolled out 1,000 different ways. I mean, this is what Voltaire is sort of trumpeting in Candide. This is David Hume in the 18th century Scottish Enlightenment philosopher. He's sort of the Christopher Hitchens, he's sort of the Christopher Hitchens of a couple hundred years ago. All kinds of people have voiced what we call the problem of evil. Now, technically speaking, let me note that it has been solved. The intellectual problem of evil has been solved to the satisfaction of philosophers, and so you can read about Alvin Plantinga's free defense theory and other things. I'm not going to go into that. And secondly, let me just state that the problem of evil is a problem for everybody. And this is one of the things that actually led C.S. Lewis to faith in Christ. So he was, when he was an atheist, one of his objections to God was that evil existed. And how could he believe in a good God given all the injustices of the world? He wrote, and I'm going to read this. "My argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Thus, in the very act of trying to prove that God did not exist, in other words, that the whole of reality was senseless, I found myself forced to assume that one part of reality, namely my idea of justice, was full of sense." So Lewis was assuming a measuring rod to say that things were bad, and when he realized that he had a measuring rod, he wondered where he got this. And of course, in Romans chapter 1, Paul writes about this, that God has written some things about who he is and his law in our heart, and we can try and suppress those things, but we can't ultimately deny him. So the problem of evil is a problem for everybody, the atheist as well as the Christian. And let me also say, the Bible has a lot of wealth to provide for people that are trying to work through thinking well about suffering. So I've already mentioned Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? It's one of many psalms in which questions of suffering and confusion about what God is doing are prominent. Psalm 10 opens, "Why, Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" Of course, it's not just the Psalms. The book of Job is a book that goes right after questions of suffering. What is God doing? Why would God allow good people to suffer? The book of Proverbs, which is also part of the wisdom literature of the Bible, right alongside the book of Job, the book of Proverbs sort of says, if you are wise, if you live well, if you follow the righteous path, then your life will work. And then you've got the book of Job right next to it that says, not always. And you've got the prophets. Habakkuk opens his book. How long, Lord, must I call for help, but you don't listen? In Ecclesiastes, Solomon is wrestling with some of the injustices of life and that confuse him. And it's not just the Old Testament. There's no New Testament book that specifically is all about suffering, but many of them just assume it. I mean, Paul's writing a lot of his books from a prison cell where he is suffering in a first century Roman prison. And he's writing about joy, but he's suffering, and he's suffering because he's been faithful. And it raises questions of suffering. Books like Peter and Hebrews and others are not just about suffering, but they're written to people who are going to suffer or who are suffering at the time. So the Bible provides a lot of rich resources for us. And when you look at those, you see answers being given for why things are the way they are. We, of course, have got the whole issue of sin, and we understand that this is a broken world that God is showing up to fix. And in the book of Job, you've got this wonderful, if you've read Job recently and you get all the way to the end, you know, you get this wonderful passage where Job has been crying out to God, God, this isn't fair. Why is the suffering going on? And when God finally shows up, because Job is asking and he goes through his counselors and finally he's going, God, you know, I want a court. I want to understand this. You need to show up. And when God shows up in Job 38, these are just wonderfully poetic, profound words. He goes, Who's asking this question? Who is darkening counsel with words without wisdom? Were you there when I created everything? Were you there when I did this? Do you understand any of this? And it sets up the point that a God who is powerful enough to create things, a God who deserves our worship, is likely a God who understands things that we cannot understand and might have good plans for things that look bad to us. Paul will write about suffering, and he sort of keeps reminding us that eternity changes everything, and the problems we're going through, these light momentary afflictions, are creating for us an eternal weight of glory. And so there are a number of places that we'll also talk about the fact that suffering and problems and trials that we go through can make us better people. They refine us. We become more like gold. The Bible has a lot to say about suffering. It has rich, robust answers. And so I want you to know, right, that the confusion and unsettledness that you might feel, the Word of God is the place to turn. Additionally, I want you to know, if you have intellectual questions about this, that it's not just the Bible, but we have rich resources in the Christian faith that take us forward. So we have a couple thousand years of people who have suffered and then reflected on it and have written for us. And some of these works are immensely profound. 20 years ago, 30 years ago maybe, when Sherry and I were out in Washington, college ministry, there was a college pastor on the other side of the state who, Jerry Sitzer, whose mom, wife, and daughter were all killed by a driver who was impaired. And in one moment, he loses three generations of women in his family. And it's, of course, unthinkable that this could happen. And we were all sort of praying for him and sort of have watched from a distance as he went through this. He was very clear that he would end his life in a heartbeat, except he had other children. He's like, I can't even do what I want to do because I have these other children I need to be there for. And so after about 10 years, he wrote a book, and the book is called something about grace, and now I can't find it. I thought I wrote the name down. But he wrote a book, yes, A Grace Disguised, How the Soul Grows Through Loss. And there are so many books like this in which Christ followers struggle with questions of God's goodness and suffering and what's going on and reflect and provide a path for us. So you can hardly imagine the depth of resources. And the last thing I'll say to those of you who are wondering intellectually how to make sense of this is you only have a handful of options when it comes to making sense of suffering. So there's the karmic religions like Hinduism, which basically say, look, we're reincarnated and there is no unjust suffering. If you're suffering, there is a sort of a grand scheme to everything. No one suffers unjustly. If you're suffering now, it's for something you did in a previous life. Now, as an aside, there are lots of people that show up at church who basically have a karmic understanding of Christianity, and it's not at all in line with the gospel. They think, if I'm good, good things will happen. If I do good things, then God is going to give me a way forward. I'm not going to lose my job. If I go to church, I'm not going to get COVID-19. And those are people that don't begin to understand, and maybe it's you, don't begin to understand the good news of the gospel, which is not that I've got to be good for God to be good to me. It's that I'm not good. He knows the worst about me, and he loves me, and there is an offer of unmerited favor from God that is extended to us through Christ. But there's a lot of people who believe everything sort of works out. You reap what you sow. What goes around comes around. There's this grand karmic thing that is happening. And so there's no unjust suffering. And if somebody is suffering, they just ought to resign themselves to it because they deserve it. There's the sort of the Buddhist approach to suffering. And this, I mean, Buddhism is formed out of a desire to make sense of suffering. And so the Buddha leaves his father's palace and he goes out and he discovers all these things that are wrong and all this suffering that's going on in the world. And he sits under the tree and he contemplates what's going on and he comes up with this fourfold understanding, right? And he comes to the understanding that part of the reason that there's suffering is because life is suffering, and that suffering comes through desire. And so the way forward is to get rid of desire, right? The way to not suffer is to not want. And then the last part of the Four Noble Truths is the eight steps to enlightenment, which is often about seeing so much of what we understand is as an illusion. I'm not a Buddhist. I can't do credit to Buddhism. But there's a whole sense in which If the reincarnation religions, if Hinduism is saying, look, you're just getting what you deserve, Buddhism would say, try not to understand it or embrace it or to want so that you can avoid suffering. And then you've got sort of the shame and honor cultures that say suffering is a chance to be strong, to be a stoic, right? To take one for the tribe. And then you've got where many people are today in the West, you've got sort of a secular approach to suffering, which is not a very good approach to suffering. And so secularism, which says there is no God, or there's certainly no God that's intervening, what's really real is material, and so seek value in material things or in this life, and whatever it is that you want in this life, that's what's going to give you meaning. And so when suffering comes along, it almost always strips us of those things that we see are giving us meaning. And so secular people have a very difficult time suffering. So, look, those are the four alternative approaches that we have to suffering that we can choose from. What the Christian faith puts forward is something that is quite different than that. And this is where we shift from answers that sort of satisfy our head to an answer that I think profoundly satisfies our heart. And that is what we get in the Christian faith is an understanding that suffering is real, that unjust suffering is real. Indeed, we have a cry of God on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Which is Jesus citing Psalm 22, but it's also Jesus giving voice, at least in some way, to this sense that this pain and suffering he's enduring is going on long enough. And behind all of that is this crazy idea that God has shown up to suffer alongside us and in fact to suffer for us. It's not, in the end, what the Christian faith gives us is not some airtight syllogism, it's not some philosophical proof to make sense perfectly of suffering and pain, but God shows up, right? And he's not inured from our pain and suffering. He's there. He has shown up for you. The Father knows what it's like to lose a son. Jesus knows what it's like to suffer unjustly. We have a high priest who understands everything that we're going through. And he's there because of his love. And it doesn't always answer every intellectual question that we have. But what would you rather have? A perfect answer, or the love and the grace of God showing up for us. Now, I step back and say, you know, this didn't feel very much like a sermon. I'd love for this to have been a conversation. And for some of you, it's like, oh my goodness, it felt like a comparative religion class or a philosophy lecture. So let me just step back for a second and say, the question is not, does what I share help? The ultimate question before you is it true? Right? We don't look for an answer simply to help us sleep through the night. That may be what you want, and there are times when anything that will help us sleep through the night would be good, but what is presented with the Christian faith is not something that, quote unquote, works, therefore we say it's true. What is presented is a claim that this is true, therefore it works. Now, I'm getting ahead of myself because this, in one sense, this is next week's sermon. This starts Holy Week. And so if you get emails from us all throughout the course of this week, we're going to be walking through Holy Week, and there's devotions, and there's things that are going to be happening during the course of the week. We've got a Maundy Thursday opportunity, and there's a Good Friday service, and so all these things are happening. Next Sunday, on Easter, what I'm going to make the big claim is that, look, Christianity makes a historic claim to be true, It's not a claim that it works or that it will help you or that will give you a sense of peace. No, the claim is that it's true that God showed up. And part of the way that it's true and part of the reason we have to think that it's true is because everybody agrees the tomb is empty. And when you look at the life of Jesus, it's obvious. It makes a whole lot more sense to believe this man would conquer death than to believe he was simply a man. So that will be next week. This week, what I am saying is, be encouraged. It's true. And what is true is that God showed up for you. Some of you are suffering or will suffer. I want you to know you never suffer alone. Right? That there's good, rich resources to understand what God is doing, but the principal resource that we come to is the fact that God set aside heaven, showed up as a baby, lived a perfect life, loved and taught, and then died in our place. And we come to this table, this communion table, in order to be reminded of the death of Jesus Christ in our place. And we come here for the kind of encouragement and sustenance to go on in life. So if you have bread and cup at home, as we've suggested that you do, it doesn't have to be a chalice, it doesn't have to be, you know, a fancy plate, it doesn't have to be matzo bread, cracker, bread, any kind of juice will work. I want to encourage you to join with me as we come to this table. On the night that he was betrayed unjustly, Jesus Christ, God himself, who had become fully man while remaining fully God, says, this Passover meal is about me. It's always been about me, right? And at the Last Supper, he changes that Passover celebration into Holy Communion, and he says, this is my body, which is given for you. Take and eat in remembrance of me. And then in a like manner, after supper, he took the cup and he says, this cup represents the new covenant in my blood given for you. Drink this in remembrance of me. And then Paul adds, as often as we eat of this bread or drink of this cup, we proclaim the fact, Lord's death until he returns. What we are proclaiming, God showed up. God has suffered for you. You never suffer alone. Christianity has rich resources for those that are suffering. Answers that satisfy our head, more importantly, has answers that satisfy our heart. May God be with you this week. Amen.